The topic for tonight's debate, as you well know, is evolution versus intelligent design. If you are interested in hearing a rebroadcast of the event, it will be on New Rock 90.7. We don't have an official time yet, but probably on Monday night. Before we begin, I'd like to go over the format for tonight's debate. In just a few moments, I'm going to introduce our two speakers for tonight. Then each speaker will be allowed 20 minutes for opening statements. Once opening remarks are concluded, we will open the floor for questions from you, the audience. Please keep your questions to one question, and we want questions, no statements. The speaker to whom the question is addressed will be allowed 3 minutes to answer the question, after which the other speaker will have 3 minutes for rebuttal. With 90 minutes into the program, I will announce to you that there's time for just one or two more questions, and after that's done, each speaker will be given 5 minutes for closing remarks. At this time, I'm going to introduce our two speakers. Dr. Paul Nelson, right here, who will be representing Intelligent Design, is a philosopher of biology who received his PhD from the University of Chicago in 1998, where he specialized in the philosophy of biology and evolutionary theory. He is currently a fellow of the Discovery Institute and adjunct professor in the MA program in Science and Religion at Biola University. Paul's articles have appeared in Biology and Philosophy, Zygon, Rhetoric and Public Affairs, and Touchstone, and chapters in the anthologies Mere Creation, Signs of Intelligence, Intelligent Design Creationism and Its Critics, and Darwin Design and Public Education. His forthcoming monograph on Common Descent critically evaluates the theory of common descent. Paul is a member of the Society for Developmental Biology and the International Society for the History, Philosophy, and Social Studies of Biology. Paul resides in Glenview, Illinois, a northern suburb of Chicago. He is married to Suzanne P. Nelson, MD, MPH, an assistant professor of pediatric gastroenterology at Northwestern University, and has two daughters, Hannah and Olivia. Dr. Michael Sherman, representing Evolution, is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the director of the Skeptics Society, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptics Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology, and the co-host and producer of the 13-hour Family Channel television series Exploring the Unknown. He is the author of Science Friction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown, about how the mind works and how thinking goes wrong. His book, The Science of Good and Evil, Why People Cheat, Gossip, Share, Care, and Follow the Golden Rule,
is on the evolutionary origins of morality and how to be good without God. He wrote a biography, In Darwin's Shadows, about the life and science of the co-discoverer of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace. He also wrote The Borderlands of Science and the Fuzzy Land Between Science and Pseudoscience, and Denying History, on Holocaust denial and other forms of pseudo-history. His book, How We Believe, Science, Skepticism, and the Search for God, presents his theory on the origins of religion and why people believe in God. He is also the author of Why People Believe Weird Things, on pseudoscience, superstitions, and other confusions of our time. Now, please keep your applause until the end, but with no further ado, we will begin opening statements with Dr. Paul Nelson.
I apologize for having to stand over here like the wizard in The Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain. But live by technology, die by technology. In any event, you're going to be looking at the screen. You'll hear my voice. A 20-minute talk is like running the 440. It's not a dash, but it's not a distance event either. You've got to go, 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 go. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you intelligent design in 3 easy steps. And here they are. 1, realize what you already do. And I'll explain what I mean by that in just a moment, but I want to reacquaint you with a reasoning ability that you have that you use every day. Secondly, look carefully at the evidence. We'll spend the most time on this second step, looking at biological evidence. Lastly, ignore philosophical rules. Now, this last step is very dangerous, especially if you intend to have a career in the sciences. And I need to say that right up front, because I don't minimize the political or social cost to advocating intelligent design if you intend to have a career in the sciences. Step 1, realize what you already can do. Now, this is a real-life example, and I'm going to show you that you can detect intelligent causation with great facility. In fact, you do this every day. This is the front page of the LA Times from March 31, 2003. If you remember, in March 2003, the Iraq War was going on. Look at the upper left-hand portion of this front page of the paper. That's the best real estate in a newspaper, above the fold, left-hand side. It's a very dramatic picture. Here it is. Now, this picture was taken by an LA Times photographer in Basra, in southern Iraq, and that's a British Marine. And that British Marine is telling those people to stay down because mortar fire is coming into the area. Now, you're an LA Times subscriber, you live in Brentwood, you go out in your bathrobe, you pick the paper up and bring it back, and you see this photograph. And you sit down with your coffee, and there's something odd that strikes you about the photograph. See if you can figure out what it is. Look in particular at the left-hand portion of the photograph. Look, for instance, at the curve of this man's back and the curve of this man's back and the bend of his knee. Michael's laughing because he's probably an LA Times subscriber and knows about this. Look at this man's profile and this man's profile, or that face and that face. There are an unusual number of identical twins in the left-hand portion of that photograph. And the reason they're there is that picture actually never occurred as photons entering the lens of a digital camera. These two pictures did. And the photographer looked at them and he saw that this was a more dramatic image. This picture of this British Marine was more dramatic than that. And that was more dramatic than that. So he photoshopped the images together. But he didn't tell his editors in Los Angeles. And the LA Times, like all newspapers that I know, has an editorial policy that they will not publish pictures that have been electronically manipulated unless they tell their readers. So if you go on the web and read the whole sad story, the guy was fired. Justifiably fired. Now, there's your toolkit. You're a reader of the paper, you see this puzzle, you want to explain it. What are you going to do? Now think about this as a puzzle. And think about it irrespective of everything else you believe about the world, theological, religious, political, whatever. You just have a puzzle that you wish to explain, and there's your toolkit. And there's your puzzle. Now, the rational thing to infer, really the only thing to infer from that pattern, is that there's not a natural cause. In fact, when you read the accounts of how this was discovered, the first thing that the editors did at the Times is they ran through all the possible natural causes for why that could have happened. And they quickly exhausted them because there aren't that many. And intelligent causation was the only reasonable inference. He lost his job. You already detect design. You do so on a daily basis. And the fact is, you do it with such facility that you don't even realize it. But you could not get through your day as a human being without being able to say, that event had an intelligent cause, that event had a natural cause, and I can discriminate between the two. And these inferences to intelligent causation are remarkably stable. There's Stonehenge, multi-ton monoliths, mysterious pattern on a plain outside Bath, England. It's been there for a long time. And there's only one reasonable inference about that pattern. A Roman centurion in the first century AD, riding out with his troops, would have made the same inference that you do. And I tell you, that inference will be stable when the current theories of physics, like string theory, and our current theories of biology are long gone. And they will go, because that's what happens in the history of science. Theories get turned over and they disappear. But the inference that intelligent design was responsible for Stonehenge will not change until the thermodynamic heat death of the universe. These are stable inferences, and we use them in all kinds of different aspects of human life. All types of forensic investigation require it. TV programs like CSI illustrate this. Cryptography and cryptanalysis, code making and code breaking, remote sensing and planetary science. How do you know that a major industrial corporation is polluting and you're using a satellite to detect that? Well, you know, because that corporation is putting out something, let's say a particular heavy metal, whose origin can only be explained in such quantities by reference to intelligence. Archaeology is self-evident. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence is really the most interesting case up there. Because what we're looking for in that instance is not a member of our species. Suppose you're sitting at a radio telescope looking at the console. You get a strong narrow band frequency. And that frequency is carrying, let's say, a series of prime numbers, numbers divisible by themselves in one. What you know about the source of that signal is only that they can grasp mathematical objects like prime numbers and they can manipulate the electromagnetic spectrum. What their biology might be like, totally mysterious. But you, in just those two criteria, have good evidence of intelligence. But you say, Paul, how about things like this? That's my daughter Olivia in the right-hand corner. And that shot went wide, by the way. She was able to stop it. She's a very good goalkeeper. How about biological objects? Drosophila melanogaster in the upper left-hand corner. There's a tunicate, looks like a little red potato, pandas, my daughter, and Richard Dawkins. How about the origin of biological objects? Can we use design reasoning there? I think we can. But I warn you, the philosophical temperature starts to go up quite rapidly. Because if there's an intelligent cause for those biological objects I showed you, it wasn't a member of our species. Now I want to look in a little depth at the phenomenon of minimal complexity in biology. This is kind of a kissing cousin to Mike Behe's idea of irreducible complexity. Minimal complexity asks the question, and there's a very large literature in biology now about this, how simple can an organism be and yet exist? What does an organism need just to survive? And this is the theater in which our little drama will take place. Down at the bottom, in the prebiotic realm, you're unquestionably dead. The asphalt on the parking lot outside, let's say. At the top, you're unquestionably alive. All of us in this room drawing our share of oxygen and so forth. There's a gray zone in the middle where it's not clear just where you lie. A large virus, let's say, might be near the darkest part of that gray zone. But we have two clear areas where you're alive or not alive. Now, the usual approach to the problem of the origin of life is to go bottom up. And the reason science goes that way is because they're trying to recapitulate what happened in the history of life on Earth. When the Earth formed, there were no organisms. About 3.8 billion years ago, by current models, life first appeared. So the bottom-up approach tries to recreate the process of going from non-living entities to the living state. But we can also approach the problem top-down. Now here we're saying, how much can we take away and still have a living entity? How much can we subtract from a cell, let's say, and work down towards that lower threshold? Because it's going to be important that the top arrow and the bottom arrow intersect in the middle. You can think about this like a tunneling crew going through a mountain in Switzerland. Now, it should be intuitively clear to you that if crew one is not communicating with crew two, it's overwhelmingly likely that they're going to miss each other. They've got to be able to intersect in the middle to have a functional tunnel. Well, the same problem exists with the origin of life. If a top-down analysis tells us you need too much hardware to have a cell from what bottom-up processes can produce, there's going to be a problem for natural theories of the origin of life. So there's our little theater in which the drama will take place. Now I want to quickly sketch for you, because we're going to critically analyze it, the leading current hypothesis for the natural origin of life. It's called the RNA world hypothesis, and it's very elegant. It solves a long-standing problem in evolutionary reasoning about the origin of life that was a classic chicken and egg difficulty. Most of the work in your cells is done by proteins. Some is done by catalytic RNAs, but most of the work is done by proteins. But proteins, to be produced, need an information source that codes for them, and that's DNA. DNA, unfortunately, is chemically very inert. It's a good way to store information, but it's a very poor actor in terms of what the jobs are that need to be done in the cell. So it looks like you need DNA to make protein, but you need proteins to service DNA to get the information out. So for a long time, there was this closed loop problem in abiogenesis research. The remarkable thing about RNA and the way that it sort of broke through that closed loop is that it can both store information because it's nucleic acid like DNA, but unlike DNA, it can fold up into lots of interesting shapes that will do things for you in the cell. And I've illustrated, this is just a cartoon, but there are plenty of real RNA molecules, they're called ribozymes, that perform functions for you. So it looked like the RNA world hypothesis would solve this problem, this chicken and egg problem. And the argument is that the first replicating entity was not a whole cell, that would be magic, but rather a ribozyme that could make copies of itself. Well, once you have a process in which you're making copies, Darwinian selection can begin to act and refine that copying process, and then natural selection kicks in, and you're on your way with an evolutionary trajectory towards increasing complexity. Like I said, it's an elegant idea. So, very schematically, our first replicators are making copies of themselves, and they're heading probably to be engulfed in a membrane towards the living state. Now, even though the RNA world hypothesis is currently the leading candidate, lots of scientists are skeptical of it, and they're not intelligent design theorists like me. For instance, Stuart Kaufman at the Santa Fe Institute, about 10 years ago, had a publication where he said, you know, I don't buy it, and here's why. And the reason I don't buy it is there's one problem that's the one most rarely talked about. All living things seem to have a minimal complexity below which it is impossible to go. In other words, there's a lower threshold that if you cross it, you cease to be as a living entity. Some part is gone that you needed to maintain the living state. And that's discoverable. That blue line is discoverable. And Kaufman goes on, He says, all free living cells have at least the minimum molecular diversity of Pleuromona, and I'll explain what that word means in a sec. He says, your antennae should quiver a bit here, meaning this is more than a random fact about biology. This minimal complexity is deeply significant. There's Pleuromona. Mycoplasma is the genus name for this particular parasitic bacterium that infects the epithelia of your upper airway and your genital tract if you have a mycoplasma infection. It's a very stripped-down cell, one of the simplest free-living things that we know. He goes on, why is there this minimal complexity? Well, let's forget about the bottom-up approach for a moment and do a top-down analysis. Mycoplasma was one of the first organisms to have all of its DNA sequenced. Not a lot of DNA, it's just a little over 500,000 base pairs. And that was published in 1995 by Claire Fraser and colleagues in Science. Now, I realize you can't read this, but I wanted to show you this figure anyway, because this is what actually you will find in the paper. It's the parts list, or at least a large part of the parts list, for that organism. And those single lines represent individual proteins broken down in terms of the functions that they perform. The functions which are jointly constitutive of the living state for that cell. So the largest group, for instance, is the one that performs DNA translation. There are the most number of proteins in that group. But each of these functions has some number of proteins associated with it. Here's what they look like in a ribbon and barrel diagram. This protein is involved in cell division, in locating the midline of the cell so that it can divide during its life cycle. There's a very different protein. Actually, it's a multi-protein complex. It's a chaperone, which associates with the ribosome during the process of protein folding to allow some, but not all of the proteins of mycoplasma to fold. Some of the larger ones need to be isolated in that central chamber. Notice that those are very different shapes. Here's another one. This protein functions in the process of actually assembling proteins. Now notice that those three shapes are as different from each other as a saw is from a hammer from a screwdriver. And the reason they're different is because at the cellular level, when you look at what the job is that they're performing, those are different jobs. And if you went through that whole list of parts, you'd find a wide array of different proteins. Now, when I saw something like that, and Claire Fraser and others saw that list, they said, well, how much of this can we take away and still have a cell alive in culture? And that experiment was done. It was published first in Science in 1999, and then again in the Proceedings of the National Academy last month. They redid the experiment, and they tightened up some of the controls to eliminate some uncertainties the first time that they did it. Now, in 1999, December, when that issue of Science arrived, and I read that article, the words jumped off the page at me, which happens a lot in biology now. Biology is the most exciting science right now, I think, in all of the natural sciences. Here's what they did. They took a piece of DNA called a transposon, and in this cartoon, the transposon is greatly enlarged so you can read the name. It's not to scale. Transposon, or this one in particular, transposons integrate themselves randomly into other DNA. And they did that over and over again, using colonies of mycoplasma, and what happens is sometimes the transposon crashes into an essential gene. When it does, it disrupts the reading frame of that gene, so that gene can no longer produce a functional protein. Now, if it turns out that that protein is essential for that cell will send you a signal back, it will die. Now, if you do that often enough, you can get a pretty good map of the genes that are essential to keep that cell alive in culture, because sometimes you won't hit any essential genes. And if you take those populations on the right and sequence their DNA and work backwards, working your way around that chromosome, the very fact that you see a transposon there in a living cell in culture tells you that gene is probably not essential, at least under these laboratory growth conditions. So they did this experiment twice, and I'll give you their results from the second time they did it. Their analysis suggests that 382 of the 482 protein-coding genes of Mycoplasma genitalium are essential under laboratory growth conditions. Now, this is not a hot spring in Yellowstone. This is not an Arctic zone where you might have to hang on by your fingernails if you're a bacterium. This is rich culture media and postdocs and grad students saying, please don't die, please don't die. This is sort of optimal conditions. Notice that last bit, though, 110 genes of unknown function. Now, that's when the words jumped off the page at me from this article. Here's their first conclusion. It's interesting, but it's not the most interesting one. They say that the presence of so many genes of unknown function among the essential set of one of the simplest known living things suggests that we don't really know how biochemistry works. Which is true. That's not the message that one would get from a molecular biology textbook. But here's the real kicker. Look at that ratio. 110 of 382. 28% of the essential hardware of mycoplasma is unknown function. Now, why is it unknown function? Now, here I'm going to have to abbreviate my story considerably because I have 1 minute left. It's unknown function, and these genes have come to have a name. They're called orphan genes because those 28%, those genes belong only to mycoplasma and not to other bacteria. If you go to another group, an unrelated bacterial group, you'll find that it has its own percentage of unknown genes, and so on, such that one gets a remarkable pattern like this, where with each new microbe that's sequenced, biology is discovering unknown genetic words, to make a linguistic parallel, that science has never seen before. Where did all that novel genetic information come from? And in the case of mycoplasma, it appears to be essential to the function of that little cell. Well, cut to the chase, do bottom-up and top-down functional analyses intersect? No. There's a huge complexity gulf between them, between what we know from an analysis of living things and what bottom-up processes can produce. I see that I have run out of time. Can I just have one more minute? All right. There's no plausible pre-biological pathway, even to make RNA. Our tunneling crews are not going to intersect. Well, could life have been intelligently designed? Now we come to step three. If you want to consider the possibility that the first cell was designed by an intelligence and not brought about by strictly natural processes, you are going to have to ignore a philosophical rule that dates to the middle of the 19th century, and there it is. As pronounced by the National Academy, the statements of science must invoke only natural things and processes. That means that even if intelligence is possible, if it's not Homo sapiens, it's out of your toolkit. Now, I suggest that that's a bad rule. What if life was intelligently designed? And in the Q&A, I'll go into other lines of evidence that I think indicate this. I went into some detail with one. You're going to have to ignore that rule. Why is intelligent design reasonable in the left-hand case and not in the right? Does it have anything to do with the evidence or what we're going to let the evidence tell us? In the background is this main rule. If you want to play with the ideas of intelligent design, make sure you are working with evolutionary biologists. If you want to criticize evolutionary theory, make sure you understand it first. The route to working with intelligent design passes through a thorough education in evolution first, because that right now is the main theory. And if you want to criticize it, you got to know it. Because we're looking at one world after all. Everybody's working on the same problems. And the way to discover if you've made a mistake is to work with someone who disagrees with you. And now I will turn it over to Michael, who disagrees with me. Thank you very much. And thank you for the extra time, Michael. I appreciate it.
You'll be granted 2 extra minutes for your opening statements.
Okay, how we doing?
Whoa.
God has spoken. How we doing? Good evening. You can say hi back or something, you know. I came all the way from California, you know, the left coast. Are all those liberals teaching all that evil evolutionary stuff? Well, my quick response is, so what? Just because you, Dr. Nelson, can't figure out how RNA leads to DNA, so what? Maybe somebody else will figure it out. Maybe they haven't figured it out yet. The reason we looked for natural explanations for natural phenomenon is because what would the other kinds look like? What kinds of non-natural explanations would we have? So starting with this, the question then on the table is, what do I hit to progress? Just anything? Oh, on the mouse, okay. Oh, I just threw this in because of all the Muslim cartoon business. Here's one for my side. News just to hand, 15,000 rioting atheists have stormed a newspaper after 12 blank sheets were found on a cartoonist's desk. See, you can have a sense of humor about these things, I think is a good idea. So is life naturally designed or is it intelligently designed? That's the question on the table. I'd like to slightly rephrase it. That is, actually follows, Paul, your presentation. Is it natural bottom-up design or is it supernatural top-down design? Dr. Nelson suggests that we get beyond this philosophical restriction on natural causes and go to something else. Like what? Well, supernatural. Well, we have certain principles that we apply in science and skepticism. I'm the publisher of Skeptic Magazine. We investigate all kinds of claims of the paranormal, pseudoscience, fringe groups and cults, and claims of all kinds between science, non-science, junk science, voodoo science, pathological science, and plain old nonsense. And there's a lot of it out there. The single most popular topic in the last 2 years for us has been intelligent design. That is, the most questions and queries we get. So we have to begin with certain principles, the known and the unknown. And before we say something is out of this world, we have to first make sure that it's not in this world. I mean, it's possible that aliens backed Arnold in his run for the governorship, but what's more likely? Before we invoke a supernatural or extraordinary out of this world explanation, perhaps the World Weekly News just makes stuff up. By the way, I've been tracking the iconography of aliens for a couple of decades. UFOs and aliens are another big thing for Skeptic Magazine. This is the first alien I've ever seen with a buff body build. He's on the Arnold Workouts program. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. When Darwin published his theory of evolution, it was an extraordinary claim, and he had an uphill battle to prove and provide extraordinary evidence, which he spent 20 years accumulating, even writing in a whole chapter, Problems on Theory, of all the critiques he could think of that his friends could think of before he published. And in the century, and almost nearly in a half, since the publication of that book, there has been cumulative evidence for this. All the other theories of evolution, and there were others, you don't hear anything about. You probably don't even know anything about them. Why? Because they were wrong. And it wasn't because Darwin became famous that we respect him today. It's because he was right. Freud and Marx were equally large figures, and they were simply wrong, and that's why we don't hear much about them today either. By the way, this is the first place where Darwin camped, on the lava fields there, the very, very first place he stopped in the Galapagos Islands. The either-or fallacy is what we were observing tonight. That is, disproving evolution does not prove intelligent design. In science, or any kind of knowledge field, if you want people to accept your theory, you need to provide positive evidence in favor of it, not negative evidence against the other theory that you don't like. It's okay to find negative evidence against the other theory you're critiquing, but to replace that theory with a new theory, you have to have positive evidence in favor of it. So Dr. Nelson's entire presentation was this argument that evolution does not explain the origins of self-replicating molecules, therefore intelligent design did it. No, that isn't any evidence at all. There's no positive evidence in that for an intelligent designer, the existence of one, how it worked, or anything like that. It's just saying, you guys, you evolutionary theorists, can't explain that. That doesn't provide positive evidence in favor of your own theory. And finally, the second to last fossil fallacy, or one fact is not a science make, even if it was the case that Dr. Nelson was right, and that the evolutionary biologists were completely wrong about RNA leading to DNA and the self-replicating molecules. Let's say that theory is completely wrong. A, that doesn't prove that intelligent design is right. And in any case, that's not what the theory of evolution is built upon. It's not built upon a single fact. It's built upon a huge body of facts. One fact is not a science make. This is a sequence of evolution of whales. Creationists are fond of asking for just one transitional fossil between land mammals and marine mammals here. In this particular case, when I first, my very first debate against Dwayne Gish, he asked for one transitional fossil in whales, and this particular one had just been published in Science, Ambulocetus natans, the one second from the top here, and he said now there's two gaps in the fossil record instead of just one. So in that case, evidence is the more evidence you have, the worse your case gets, which is not how science works. In fact, there's a convergence of evidence from lots of different lines of inquiry. For example, we have at least three different dating techniques that have been found to be very reliable. Uranium lead, rubidium, and carbon-14. Age of the Earth, age of the Moon, the age of the solar system, and the age of the universe are all within the same time frame, within an order of magnitude of each other. If it was that one dating system had the Earth at 4.5 billion years old, and another dating system had, say, the solar system at 10,000 years old, we'd have a problem. The theory of evolution would not be supported by this convergence of evidence. But in fact, from lots of different lines of inquiry, it adds up. So even if you can say, okay, this particular factoid is wrong, or that particular line of inquiry is wrong, there's hundreds of them that all converge together. And it's not like these guys meet on the weekends and say, okay, we got to get our story straight here, you know, because those creationists are trying to get in public school, so I'm going to say that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old. How old are you going to say it is? Or whatever the particular problem is. They publish in different journals, they work in different labs, and their lines of inquiry converge to this particular conclusion that it's true. So for evolution to not be true, there would have to be a huge line of problems with all the different laboratories and inquiries and scientists and journals and articles and so on, not just one or two. And finally, the last point that Dr. Nelson brought up, this is what we call methodological naturalism, or no miracles allowed. This is the famous Sidney Harris cartoon here with the mathematicians at the chalkboard, and he writes in here, then a miracle occurs, and he says, I think you need to be more explicit here in step two. This right here, I could just end it right here. This is the end of the line for intelligent design. The reason you can't do this is not because Donald Kennedy said in the journal Science you can only have natural causes. That's not why. There is nobody that set out the rules of the methods of science. In fact, there is no such thing as the scientific method. Like if you walk into a lab, you're going to see a big chart on the wall that says, step one, collect data. Step two, form a hypothesis. Step three, test a hypothesis. There's nothing like that, because that's not how it works. There's no committee that says, you can only have natural causes. The reason they aren't invoked is because they don't do anything. It doesn't lead to anything. There's no testable hypothesis. It's the end of the line. It's the end of the conversation. So if you determine, and by the way, Stonehenge, there are people who think Stonehenge was built by aliens. I know, because we debunked them in Skeptic. But even if you think it's some supernatural force, multidimensional beings came in from the 14th dimension through string theory loops and came in and built Stonehenge, yeah, prove it. Like, what do they look like? Where are they? How'd they do it? When did it happen? And so forth. It's the end of the line to invoke a miracle. Just say a miracle happened doesn't lead to anything. Now, if you say a great extraterrestrial intelligence of high power and great genetic engineering ability and so on created RNA, okay, that's a hypothesis I could accept if there was some evidence for it. If we realize that, you know, we found the monolith on the moon or something that indicated that these beings actually existed. Okay, here's the way, in short, this is how intelligent design theory works. And you saw this in Dr. Nelson's presentation tonight. One, X looks designed. Two, I can't think of how X was designed naturally. Three, therefore X was designed supernaturally. That's it. And that's the end of the story. I've not seen anything else in all the literature I've read that reduces something to anything beyond that. It's what we call the God of the Gaps problem. Wherever there's a gap in scientific knowledge, That's where God stepped in to invoke the miracle. My response to that is, I think you need to be more explicit here in step three. Well, in step two, actually, in this case. In fact, this is an old problem. Sir Isaac Newton, in his great work, The Principia Mathematica, wrote toward the end of the work that he was trying to deal with the plane problem. Why are all the planets in a single plane going around in the same direction? Most of them are spinning in the same direction. That's just too weird. There are no possible natural causes to explain that. Ergo, God did it. He wrote, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." Today, nobody talks about the plane problem. I've not heard a single intelligent design theorist talk about the unusual, incredible problem of the planets all in a single plane. That must be evidence of divine intervention. Nobody makes that argument anymore. Why not? Because we have a perfectly good natural explanation for it. So here's the problem with this whole line of inquiry. If you are a religious person, if you hook your faith to a scientific argument, a finding, a RNA world problem, a plane problem, what are you going to do when science fills the gap with an explanation that everybody agrees is true? What happens to your faith? Faith is not based on scientific data. In fact, intelligent design is a religious, in my opinion, it's a religious proposition and nothing more. Dr. Dembski says, Paul Nelson's colleague, intelligent design is strictly a scientific theory devoid of religious commitments. This is not true, as we shall see. Dembski continues and says, because of ID's outstanding success at gaining a cultural hearing, the scientific research part of ID is now lagging behind. In fact, Dr. Nelson himself said in Touchstone magazine in 2004, we don't have such a theory right now, and that's a problem. Without a theory, it's very hard to know where to direct your research focus. Right now, we've got a bag of powerful intuitions and a handful of notions such as irreducible complexity and specified complexity, but as yet, no general theory of biological design. Fair enough. He's being intellectually honest here and even be willing to put it into print. And it's perfectly okay for theorists in a particular field to debate amongst themselves. But that is not a scientific theory that should be taught in public schools because they don't have a science yet. There's no science yet. When you have the science with technical hypotheses, then we can consider whether it should be part of the curriculum or not. But as yet, I can see none. What it's really going on here, I think we see from a few more quotes from Dembski and others, thus, in its relation to Christianity, intelligent design should be viewed as a ground-clearing operation that gets rid of the intellectual rubbish that for generations has kept Christianity from receiving serious consideration. If we can hook our faith onto a respectable science or turn our faith into a respectable science, then we'll gain cultural credibility because we live in the age of science. Again, that's not how faith works. Philip Johnson said a description of Philip Johnson's position in this Church and State magazine. The objective is to convince people that Darwinism is inherently atheistic, thus shifting the debate from creationism versus evolution to the existence of God versus the non-existence of God. From there, people are introduced to the truth of the Bible and then the question of sin, and finally introduced to Jesus. In my opinion, that is what's really going on here. This is not a debate about science. It's really a debate about science and religion and faith and certain motives and agendas that drive this. Still, it's perfectly okay to be a Christian and a scientist. There are lots of them. That's not really the deeper issue. But when that is what we see in the literature, and if that continually comes up, it makes me suspect. It sets off what I call my baloney detection alarm. That, wait a minute, there's something else going on here. Still, if they've got great arguments and great data, perfectly fine. Doesn't matter what your religion is if you've got great data and great theory. But when you don't, then it's okay to look at the motives. In my opinion, here are the three best arguments for intelligent design and why they do not work. Irreducible complexity is that, this is the argument that Dr. Nelson just made. That if you take out some of the parts, the classic case is the mousetrap won't work if all the parts aren't in place. But in fact, biologists have now shown how you can make a mousetrap with 4, 3, 2, and even one part. Just because ideas can't figure out how it happened doesn't mean it can't happen. In the biological world, we have what's called the problem of incipient stages. That is, what good is half a wing? And Dr. Nelson made reference to this with the RNA. What good is this RNA or that RNA without, at some point, you need something else to put it together? The answer is that here in this particular slide, different structures have different functions, and that combined they can form a new function off to the right here. So the problem with wings, for example, in Darwin's own time, one of the best arguments made against Darwin was, what good is half a wing? I can certainly see what a fully aerodynamic developed wing would be for escaping predators and so forth. What good would half a wing do, or 10% of a wing? How do you go from, in Darwinian gradualism, up to a full-fledged wing? And the answer is, because it wasn't an aerodynamic structure. It was a thermodynamic regulating structure for holding in heat. Feathers and the sort of layered structure that can be folded in or folded out. Wings are a great way, they're thin, great way of exchanging heat rapidly or holding heat if you hold them in. You can see that with the different birds in the Galapagos. This is a blue-footed booby with fully functional wings. This is a flightless cormorant with worthless little stubby wings here that it still uses when it's swimming, but it can't use them for flight. So here it's just holding them out to dry them off and then holding it in for heat. And then in the case of the Galapagos, a penguin. These are from Antarctica, but there's a cold current that runs right through the Galapagos, and that's where they came from. The wings are rudders for cruising through the water. So a single structure and a single function is not how the biological world works. A single structure can have multiple functions, or it could have had one function at one time and another time have a completely different function. So you can't today look at the structure and say, what could that possibly have been for 10 million years ago? And the answer is, it was for something completely different. It got accepted. It got used for something new. I'm going to skip the bacterial flagellum here and go to the second best argument, the design inference or the explanatory filter. How can you tell the difference between the face on Mars on the top and the face on Mars at the bottom? The answer is, squint and look at this one and you'll see the one at the top. And the reason is, by squinting you're reducing the quality of the data, which is what this is, a grainy photograph on the top. But nobody, except for the ufologists who think Martians built these things, but nobody today thinks that those are artificially made, and yet nobody would mistake the one on the right. So that's the argument, that there's a filter we can use to understand the difference between artificial and between natural design and intelligent design. And this is Dembski's chart to describe this. In essence, it's saying if you can rule out chance and natural law, then the remaining argument is design. Here's the problems with this, and this is the problem with Dr. Nelson's argument along the line as well. It assumes probabilities that cannot be determined in practice. How do you know what the probability of something happening by chance is? Most of the time we can't. What are the chances of RNA replicating and becoming DNA? Well, I don't know. Hard to say. This isn't like a casino where you can calculate the probabilities. Two, to eliminate all necessity and chance explanations, assume that we know all the configurations of them. We don't. Intelligent design is not simply the elimination of necessity and chance. Remember, you have to have positive evidence in favor of your own theory, not just ruling out the other guys. By the logic of VF, we should apply it to the designer's designer. If necessity and chance are rejected for the design's designer, the conclusion is that the design's designer was designed. Don't miss this point. This is it. By this line of reasoning, if Dr. Nelson is right that we must infer an intelligent design behind all this complexity, the intelligent designer himself, or maybe we should say herself, would have to have been intelligently designed, because that designer would have all the characteristics of what we see in this world, all that irreducible complexity and so forth. And then by logic, that designer of the intelligent designer would itself have to have a super intelligent designer, which itself would need to have a super duper really smart genius intelligent designer, and so on up the causal chain. So by the same set of arguments, okay, so what is our explanation? Then I'm going to wrap it up in my opening sentence here with statement here that you are already comfortable with understanding how complex systems arise spontaneously from simple systems. We all know how languages evolve. Nobody sat down 500 years ago and said, I know, let's speak English in that place called America. And we'll say, hey, dude, in Southern California, and so forth. This is not designed from the top down. It just happens as an emergent property of complex systems. You're also familiar with and comfortable with the free market, economies. No one designs the economy. Well, they try, but they mostly screw it up when they do. Top-down designers of economies don't work because complex systems can't be designed from the top down. They work best when they emerge spontaneously from the bottom up from simple systems. And life is the exact same way as language and the marketplace. These are emergent properties. Water is a self-organized emergent property of hydrogen and oxygen. Consciousness is a self-organized emergent property of billions of neurons firing. Complex life is self-organized emergent property of simple life. Prokaryote cells gave rise to eukaryote cells, gave rise to multicellular life, and so on. It's a nice, big, long, rich sequence of steps in the evolution of life from simple to complex. So, with that, I will stop right there. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to now open the floor up to questions from the audience. If Brett could please come up and get the microphone. If you have a question, please, once again, I'm going to reiterate, we're asking for questions only, no comments or statements. Raise your hand and Brett will bring the microphone to you. Direct your question to one of the speakers. That person will speak first. They'll have 3 minutes to answer your question. And after that, a 3-minute rebuttal will be allowed by the other speaker.
If I may, can I ask the same question of both speakers, or?
Yeah.
Okay. My question is this. Suppose both of y'all are in, say, the second speaker mentioned the sort of schools issue. I happen to be a graduate student in the college education, so these things are kind of interesting for me to think about. But suppose both of y'all, or either one of y'all, is in a biology classroom in, say a high school, middle school, whatever, and you're the biology teacher, and a student basically, I guess, raises the opposite position for you, for the intelligent design guy, raises evolution for the evolution individual, raises intelligent design. How would you respond to this particular student?
I'd send him to the principal's office right away. You talking about in public high schools? For example, not college.
Public high schools,
yeah. Well, here's the problem. They're public. They're paid for by taxes, and therefore everybody feels that they should have their say. They pay the taxes. That's the problem. So, and it's not just this is an issue. There's lots of issues like that. And so to me, the best solution in this particular case is go ahead and bring it up the first week. Just get it out on the table. If it's a big cultural thing, everybody's talking about it, then the biology teacher should say, hey, look, there's this really cool and amazing debate going on. And as far as I can tell, there's not much science to it, but they're claiming that it's science. Let's take a look at it, and then let's move on with the program. The problem would be, for example, if you were going to teach a whole curriculum, a set, you know, like say a 2-week set after the cell and the DNA, and now it's the time for X, intelligent design or whatever. After saying, that RNA can't give rise to DNA, then what do you do? What else is there to teach? Okay, back to the science. So I just don't see where the science leads, where there's any science to teach in the classroom. I mean, to say an intelligent designer did it and we all think it's God, where's the testable hypothesis? Where's the data? What is there to do in the science class? You have a lab. You got a bunch of kids out there ready to do their lab. What do they do? For life of me, I have no idea.
I actually oppose mandating and teaching intelligent design in public schools. I think that if it finds a place there in the biology curriculum, it will be according to the route that all other ideas find their way, and that is going through, you know, the scientific community and winning a place that way. What I would prefer is an open-ended teaching of evolutionary theory where students really understand the theory and the evidence for it, and then they have the same freedom that scientists themselves enjoy to raise questions about it. It's remarkable when you go into the evolutionary biology literature, you find wonderful, vigorous disputes about pretty much any aspect of evolutionary biology. Origin of sex, the origin of multicellularity, the Cambrian explosion, the origin of complex structures like the eye. And there are lots of people, not like me, not design theorists, evolutionary biologists, who don't accept the standard theory of neo-Darwinism that Michael outlined. So I think there's plenty of room and plenty of constitutional safety in saying to students, this is the theory that most scientists accept. You need to understand it. You need to understand how it works. But we're going to give you your intellectual freedom. And if you have questions about this or that aspect of the theory, we'll entertain them.
Paul, is your microphone on?
Can you hear me?
Okay, there. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, I tend to be a little soft-spoken. So I think within that framework, you got all kinds of room, and I would be perfectly happy. In fact, my 13-year-old is going to be a freshman next year. I hope that's, in fact, what she gets.
A freshman?
Oh. A first-year student.
Excuse me. Oh, yeah.
She's very strongly feminist.
She a fresh like person.
A fresh person. A ninth grader.
Hello, I'd like to say good evening, first of all. I have a question for Dr. Nelson. In Dempsey's book, in the Intelligent Design Revolution, he talks about the explanatory filter. And for a class, I had to read that book. And yes, Dempsey did give a lot of analogies to explain the explanatory filter, but he never really gave any concrete examples. And I was wondering if you could give any examples or the explanatory.
I'm sorry, I was paying attention to my non-functional microphone and I missed the first part of your question.
In the book, The Design Revolution by Dembski, he talked about the explanatory filter. And in the book, he gave a lot of analogies to explain the explanatory filter, but he never really gave any concrete examples of how you could go through that with different things to see how it works. And I was wondering if you could do so, or what do you think about there not being any concrete examples in the book?
Well, if you remember, the explanatory filter is a model to help frame the way that we actually reason about intelligent causation, because we all do it. I gave you one example of that photograph. The example that he gives in his monograph with Cambridge University Press is a guy who was responsible for setting ballot positions in New Jersey. If you know about the way that ballot positions are assigned, the first person on the ballot tends to get more votes just because that's where they are. And this particular clerk assigned the Democrats that first position 40 out of 41 times, until the Republicans in New Jersey sued, and they said there's no way that he could be doing that randomly. Now, the New Jersey Supreme Court said, you're right, there's no way he could be doing it randomly, because the probabilities are against it, and the fact that he's a Democrat always giving it to Democrats raises our suspicions. So Bill takes that example and says, other cases like this have that same feature where you have a small probability event, but it matches an independently given pattern. And I think Bill's analysis is a good first attempt to model how it is that we know that we've detected the action of intelligence. But don't forget this, we do it. In fact, in this country, Alabama's a pretty conservative state, and I'm pretty conservative politically, but I happen to be opponent of the death penalty. But in this country, we strap people to gurneys and put chemicals into their bloodstream, stop their heart, because a pattern of evidence points uniquely to them as the cause of an event that no one saw them commit. Now, that's putting a lot of weight on a design inference, but we do it all the time. So I think the challenge, and I would extend this challenge to Mike, is we know that we infer intelligent causation. How do we do it, and what are the limits on that? And he wants to say, you can't use it except if you've got a known agent. And I say that's too many restrictions. I'm sorry, you have an unhappy expression. Can I speak to you afterwards and give you some? Yeah, I only got 3 minutes to answer you.
Right, well, imagine that, rigged politics in America. I think the example of the murderer, well, yes, there's a convergence of evidence toward that particular person as the murderer, in this case, I guess. But we know, we've seen humans kill other humans. We have a history of this, a pattern of this, and we know that it's done all the time. So it's not like no one has ever murdered anybody, and all of a sudden we're going to put to death this guy on circumstantial evidence that seems to point that he was the one and only time anyone in history has ever murdered anybody. That's the difference between using, say, criminology or archaeology or even the SETI program. In the film Contact, when Carl Sagan's novel Contact, and Jodie Foster's got the earphones on. They don't do that, by the way. But in any case, it makes for more dramatic television or movies. And she's got the prime numbers coming in, and they infer that no pulsar rotating star is going to emit prime number sequences. Must be an intelligence of some kind. Yes, this is a good program for the good way of testing whether something's naturally or intelligently designed from space. But the inference is not that there's an intelligent designer called God, it's that there's some extraterrestrial intelligence sending the signal out. Like us, but more. More whatever, smarter, more advanced, something like that. I contend that if the intelligent design program is successful, what it will succeed in doing is discovering an extraterrestrial intelligence who can do really cool genetic engineering. I think that's actually really a cool thing. If we did.
My question is directed to you, Dr. Sharmer?
Yep.
And it's just, are there any theories that explain the, like, living matter arising out of non-living matter? Is there any theories y'all have to explain that?
Okay, question is on living matter coming from non-living matter. Well, gosh, this is an age-old problem. How do you get something from nothing? And so here we get from, we're really out of evolutionary theory here. This is what's called the origins of life science, and it's more biochemistry and biochemistry. And there are several interesting models to try to explain how this can happen. You saw one example of higher up on the level of how do you get first replicating molecules, self-replicating molecules. The RNA world is one theory; it's not the only one. And there's half a dozen theories of how do you go from just basically clays and organic molecules to say crude protein chains, and then protein chains that can form something of a sphere that's self-contained, and then maybe within the sphere you get these self-replicating molecules and you get the first cell and so on. But it's something of a field in its infancy. It's maybe half a century old of some rigorous science. The people I've interviewed and talked to it that are leaders in the field, they rarely agree with each other. It's a science in its infancy. I think along the same lines as trying to explain consciousness with neurons firing. I think it's just a really hard problem, and it's going to take us a long time. So rather than invoking the God of the gaps and saying, well, this is a really hard problem, I think I'll quit thinking about it and just say, a miracle happened. Why don't we be more specific at step two there and continue to work on the problem?
I will agree that it's a hard problem, and probably the safe bet, if you want to have a productive career in science, is to stick with the naturalistic program. But you need to realize this about the naturalistic program. When it got started, that is the attempt to explain the origin of life via natural causes only, when it got started in the 19th century, shortly after Darwin's death, the cell was a very simple entity indeed. Huxley described it as a little albuminous bag of stuff. It looked like a little bag full of jello in the microscopes at the time. What we've learned about cell structure since then has totally stood that picture on its head, so that any given function that you choose now in a cell is going to be mediated by an exceedingly complex system of molecular machines. Michael showed you one slide of the bacterial flagellum. I'm here to tell you it's complicated machines wherever you turn. So the distance between what natural processes can do and what they look like they could do in the 19th century versus the object that needs to be explained has greatly expanded. Such that now, I think, from my own perspective, the rational choice to make is to abandon that rule. After all, it's only a rule. It's not a necessity. Newton didn't recognize it. Darwin himself, as a young man, didn't recognize the rule. He got on the Beagle Voyage thinking that there was a God who created life. Science can jettison that rule if it stands in the way of inquiry and consider the hypothesis of design for something like the first origin of the first cell. And those hypotheses are testable. How much time do I have?
About a minute.
I want to point out a contradiction in Michael's presentation that you might have caught. If not, I want to bring it to your attention. He said that you can't test these hypotheses because they involve the supernatural. But his very next slide was from a prediction that Newton made about the structure of the solar system. And he said, you don't hear that anymore. And the reason you don't hear it anymore is because Newton's prediction actually was tested and falsified. There are lots of predictions that design theory makes that are fully testable. In fact, there are whole books dedicated to testing Mike Behe's idea of irreducible complexity. Dozens of web pages. In the late fall, I was at the AAAS building in Washington, D.C., and went to hear a talk by Chris Adami from Caltech. Chris Adami wrote a program that he published in Nature to try to refute Mike Behe's ideas of irreducible complexity. Believe me, they're testable. In fact, you saw an example in Mike's own presentation of how that happens. So it's a funny thing, but we can test these ideas.
My question is mainly for Dr. Nelson. Overall definition of intelligent design, what you mean by it, specifically coming to mind, for example, this past year's ASA meeting, both Dembski and Behe said that in principle, evolution could be fully compatible with intelligent design. They didn't have to fully believe in it, but it was compatible. This kind of ties into something you kind of briefly mentioned on the fine-tuning principle. There's sort of different aspects invoked as ID, not necessarily all matching up. So what definition are you using to clarify what you're talking about?
Intelligent design as a, I won't call it a theory because it really doesn't rise to the status of a theory yet, as an idea about how to go about inquiring into nature is quite minimal. And it says only the following. It is possible to detect the action of intelligence in nature, in objects other than those that we ourselves manipulated. Now, under that minimal heading, you can have a whole range of different ideas. I was watching Larry King like 2-3 months ago, and Deepak Chopra was on, the New Age guru, vigorously arguing for intelligent design from his perception of nature and also from the Hindu scriptures. So it's a quite a minimal position, and it is possible to advocate theories of intelligent design that accept the whole of evolutionary history. Michael sketched a little bit of that. But say the first cell was fine-tuned for design, or the universe as a whole was fine-tuned for design. So design doesn't require you to sign any statement of faith, any of that. All you have to say is, I think it's possible to detect the action of intelligence in natural systems. What can I do with that? And then, may the best theory win. So that's my definition. It's actually quite minimal.
Mm-hmm. And by that definition, then, it seems like the most logical answer, if it's not natural forces on Earth that created complex cells and so on, it would be an extraterrestrial intelligence, a really good genetic engineer. I can't see how it could be anything other than that by that definition. And at some point, if we do make contact with ET, they're not going to be anything remotely close to us in technological development. The beasties you see on Star Trek that, you know, they're bipedal primates with gnarly stuff on their forehead and they speak English with an Indian accent. The aliens aren't going to be anything like that. Because they have a much bigger budget than Paramount Studios has for costumes. And, you know, they'll be so wholly different from anything we can conceive of. They won't be anything at all like that. But not just that. They won't be behind us technologically because we just now achieved space flight and radio communication abilities and so on. They'll be ahead of us. How far ahead of us? Probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years ahead of us. Look what we've been able to accomplish in just the last century, from the Wright brothers to the moon, genetic engineering and so forth, just in half a century. Extend that out 50,000 years, 500,000 years, a million years of all this kind of progress in science. How would we perceive a being that could do that, that could create life, manipulate planets and stars, harvest the energy of an entire galaxy? To us, it would be indistinguishable from what we can think of as God. So I see no difference between invoking that concept, and if we do discover that, wouldn't we think of that as God, but in fact it ends up just being ET? Yeah, go ahead, go for it. Yeah, sure, I'm okay with that.
You know, if you guys will allow this, I'd like to continue on this vein for just a moment because it's actually very interesting. Michael and I have been friends for many years, and in November we had dinner in Pasadena, and we talked about this very point. And Michael had said to me, Paul, when it comes right down to it, how can you be sure that the designer that you're invoking is not just what he's described, this super ET, and not a transcendent deity of Western theism? And I said, you know what, I can't be sure. Because the competence of science to answer the question about the character or identity of the designer is inherently limited. The most we can do is get to a generic intelligence. But when it comes to the questions about who the designer was, or it could have been a committee, it could have been a Humean teenager, you know, the Earth is his project and he went on his way, the flying spaghetti monster of internet fame that I'm sure many of you have seen. When it comes to that point, then more must be brought to the table. And there I think you've got to bring in philosophy, theology, everything else we know about the world. But I would agree with Michael that the competence of science to answer the question of the identity of the designer, if there is one, is inherently limited. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I agree. I mean, you're agreeing with me. Well, am I going to argue with that? Thank you. No, it's a huge issue. I mean, what could be more interesting than that? I mean, it touches on the very nature of God, religion, science, the ultimate nature of reality, and so on. We are very ignorant in a lot of these, you know, sort of big questions like that, which is why science restricts itself to those kinds of natural explanations, ones that you can get at in the lab, actually do some sort of testing. There's a movement afoot within science to be skeptical of string theory. There's sort of a fractionated physics community over string theory, and it's never been tested. This is the problem. What is it? Is it really a theory? Is it even science? Is it metaphysics? Is it just elegant mathematics and nothing more? And that's an example of when you're out there on the frontiers where you're bumping up against the sort of limitations of science, if you can't test it, then is it really even science?
How old do you think the Earth is, and what is your reasons behind that thinking?
For all the scientific work that I do, I accept the standard 4.5 billion year age for the Earth, 13.7 for the universe, and so forth. I have to tell you, though, that as a Christian, when I read the Bible, I have real problems with those dates. But I just live with that tension. And it's not a very comfortable position to be in. But all my colleagues at Discovery Institute, when I go to scientific meetings, I accept standard dates as Michael outlined them. But I want to be candid with you. When I read the Bible, I see a different picture, and I just live with the tension.
Incredible. Gosh. Well, incredible on two levels. One, the intellectual honesty to say that. That takes a lot of guts to say that, not just try to twist and rationalize it. But doesn't it matter what's actually true? And maybe the Bible's just wrong. Does it have to be right on every single point? Can it be metaphorical when it's describing nature and something else when it's talking about morals and the meaning of life and the afterlife and things like that?
Yeah, sure. No person in this room has resolved every contradiction in their thinking. No one alive has resolved every contradiction in their thinking. The honest thing to do, and the healthy thing to do, is realize where they are and identify them. And, you know, the day that I can sort out everything and make it all fit beautifully, like on an outline that you did in grade school, I'll be 6 feet down in a grave. So, the truth does matter. And this is one thing I love about Michael, and I love about the Skeptic Society, is that they care what is the case and what is not the case. And I can tell you, they are out there on the front lines battling with people for whom the truth does not matter. So with the exception of intelligent design, I love everything that the Skeptic Society does.
I get a lot of letters like this. They start off, you guys are great, I love your work, and so on. But, and then and then the letter goes on for a couple pages.
So far, like you said, Dr. Nelson said that it's better for intelligent design theorists to know as much as possible about evolution to go ahead and disprove it. I very well agree with that point, but so far it seems that intelligent design proponents are acting in a direction that they are starting with the principle that this is wrong. Like, they are working in opposite directions instead of going together for some time, and when the paths actually cross, then say it might be because of because of ID. However, what we are seeing right now is people start off with ID and ID and evolution at the onset. So do you think this is going in the right direction?
Well, there's always a danger of making your own theory parasitic on the failures of another theory. This is something that Michael pointed out in his presentation. And I agree with him. If intelligent design amounts to nothing more than boo evolution, or evolution failed here, ergo design, that would not be a very attractive theory. But there's an interesting pattern historically in where the problems in evolutionary theory have cropped up. Cambrian explosion, for instance, which is something I work on professionally. I didn't have time to talk about it tonight. I love this orphans puzzle, so I gave that to you. The Cambrian explosion was a problem for Darwin. He didn't call it that, but he had a whole section of the origin dedicated to it. That problem is worse today, 150 years later, more or less, much, much worse as a difficulty for evolutionary theory than it was in the 19th century. And it's precisely at a point like that, where you see the introduction of a whole bunch of new information all at once, that intelligent design has something to say. So I think there's an interesting congruence between the unsolved problems of evolution and where intelligent design would be likely to say something. Let me say that I love evolutionary theory. I did my PhD on it. It has accumulated a great number of tools that are necessary for biological explanation, population genetics, systematics, you name it. You've got to have them, you've got to use those tools. But it has a suite of unsolved problems that are getting harder and harder and harder by the year. To the point now that what really holds evolutionary theory in place in the grand molecules to man sense is not the story. It's that rule that I gave you, which is boo design. At that point, I think an honest investigator needs to sort of, you know, pull up his jeans and get his guts together and try something new.
Well, I guess I would only say that, from what I know of the Cambrian explosion, it's about a 20 million year period of time when these bodies suddenly appeared in the fossil record. We have to remember that sudden to a geologist is very different than sudden to a biologist. On a geological time scale, these are hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years, these bedding planes when you find these fossils. And that, in fact, there's lots of predecessors to the bodies you see in this Cambrian strata. There's these whole set of Precambrian fossils, and they're much simpler. And you do see something of a gradation there. And even within the Cambrian, we're still talking about a 20 million year span. So if you think about all the life forms that have evolved, well, just think of dogs in the last 15,000 years, or all the variation amongst people just in the last 100,000 years, all the different racial differences. And that's an eye blink. That wouldn't even be noticeable in the fossil record. So these are kind of relative terms, explosion, rapid. A biologist means something rather different than a paleontologist means by that.
This question is directed to Dr. Nelson. If we accept for the moment, for the sake of argument, that the first cell or cells were intelligently designed, let's say, would you then say that the current evolutionary theory could then adequately explain the biological diversity we observe now through the mechanisms of natural selection, common descent, and so on?
Actually, I wouldn't say that, and I'm sorry. You know, 20 minutes, it really is about the hardest time limit to give a talk, and I didn't make it, in fact. I had to beg 2 minutes from Michael. But now I have got a little more time, and I can tell you why orphans are such an interesting puzzle. Orphans are genes that belong just to one group and not to any other group. In mycoplasma, you find them only in the genus Mycoplasma, that 28%. You move away in bacterial space, you find a different set of orphans. This was not expected when genome sequencing began. And if it turns out that the biochemistries of different groups of just bacteria, let's say, require their own sets of specialized proteins, I see no way of reconciling that, at least on current theory, with a single tree picture. When I was a graduate student, The single tree, Darwin's great tree of life, his powerful metaphor of a single tree of life, was orthodoxy. Today, leading molecular evolutionists like Carl Woese at the University of Illinois have said, in print, there never was a tree of life. When the cellular state arose, it did so at several points independently. If you had told me as a graduate student that someone as senior as Woese would make that kind of statement, I never would have believed it. So I think, I was saying this to some people just before our program this evening, that right now, 2006, biology is as exciting as physics was in the first two decades of the last century when quantum theory came in, relativity and so forth. Everything is up for grabs, even Darwin's tree of life, which one would expect to be a finding that would never change. So long-winded answer, short answer, no. I think there are discontinuities right through the history of life that look like the introduction of new information, and it would be at those loci that I would look to test design theories.
To me, this is one of the most interesting problems for intelligent design theory. If how did it happen? How did id come on in and create the first cell with all the DNA that can create all the living forms we see today, and then leave? And then bug out, and evolution takes over, and evolution is id's way of doing it? Or did id come in and create the first self-replicating molecules, and then maybe RNA and DNA, and then the cell developed by itself? Or did he do the RNA, the DNA, the cell, and then complex cells, and then stopped? Does he do just the genus, but the species are created by natural selection? How about subspecies, natural selection, but species are for id only? Does id create every single one of your and my DNA molecules? Is there an answer to this? I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's an insurmountable problem to try to answer. And if the answer is E.T. did it, well, I mean, he would have had to come to Earth a lot of times to keep tweaking it and tweaking it and tweaking it. Isn't it more likely that the whole thing just happened naturally? Now, if you want to say the laws of nature are set up by God to do that, I'm perfectly okay with that. But that's not really science. It's sort of metaphysics, something like that, where the universe come from in the first place, those kinds of questions.
Hi, I have a question with actually two parts to it. The first part is for Dr. Nelson. In regards to how you mentioned there were contradictions, I guess, in the Bible as far as as far as the age of the earth, wouldn't you say that since the fact that God is incomprehensible and as humans we will never fully understand the capacity of him, couldn't you just say that his definition of time is possibly quite different from our definition of time? And although he literally might have said, I created the world in 7 days, one day could be 1,000 years, it could be 1,000,000 years. Second part of my question is for Dr. Sherber, and it's in regards to the forms of testing that are used to determine the age of the earth and so forth. Every so often, like one thing I've learned in history is that the forms of testing that are used sometimes changes throughout the years. Like it's discovered that, hey, this method was wrong. So who's to say that 10, 20, 30, however many years down the road, the forms of testing used now will actually, turn out to be inaccurate and the earth could be younger, could be older than,
Really good question. You want to take the first one?
Thank you for your question. And it gives me an opportunity to give you a picture that was given to me by a great professor, Adolf Grünbaum, an atheist instructor of mine when I was an undergraduate. He said, a lot of intellectual life has the following form. You have a hole in the ground that's bothering you. And it really bothers you, not just a little. It really bothers you. So you get your shovel, and you dig and dig and dig another hole, and you fill in the first hole. Okay? So now you filled in the first hole that bothered you. Now you've got another hole. Well, I want to agree with you that one could allegorize references to time in Scripture, and lots of people do. That comes at a cost. You dig another hole to fill in your first hole. Now your second hole raises theological problems for you. I'll give you just one in particular. The picture of the original creation appears to have been something that was truly good, not something that caused Darwin lots of problems and led him out of Christianity, namely that you had horrible predator-prey relations over literally billions of years of suffering. Now, if you allegorize time, you're going to pay a cost because you're going to make God the author of a very, very long span of animal suffering before Homo sapiens appears on the scene. You can do that, but that raises theological problems. So I guess what I'm saying to you is, pretty much any solution to the problem of trying to reconcile sort of a plain reading of Scripture with a scientific record is going to cost you somewhere.
Here's one for you. The tip of Mount Everest is marine limestone. They're sea creatures. How do they get up there? This was a huge problem long before Darwin, that somehow these things got uplifted, but you don't really see mountains growing, so how did this happen? The concept of deep time is very counterintuitive and took science a long time to figure this out. The young lady's question is a perfectly good one, because things do change in science all the time. It's very frustrating. You know, coffee's bad for you. No, it's good. No, it's bad. Might be good, might be bad. Jeez, come on. Let's get it straight here. Well, this is how it works. But in certain cases, there is this convergence. So although it's true that, say, carbon-14 dating, which can get us back several thousand years to maybe 10,000 years or so, it's best at maybe 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years for dating like archaeological artifacts. It's true that it varies a little bit, and every 10 or 20 years somebody comes up with a new method and it's slightly more refined, and it turns out that these artifacts aren't 3,500 years old, they're 4,500 years old, you know. So it can be off a little bit, and the methods are improved. But they're not off by orders of magnitude, where, for example, one particular set of dating techniques shows that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, and then the next year somebody comes up, oh, unbelievable, we just discovered that it's, you know, 10,000 years old. That never happens. So it's always kind of refined within what scientists call error bars. There's a sort of a range of errors, of variation that's allowed because, you know, the data is not always perfect.
My question is for Dr. Nelson. I'd like to thank you both for your time here first. But the question is there a way right now that we can prove intelligent design other than the fact that since there is a gap between what you were explaining, that gap between the two, and the fact that we can disprove evolution, therefore intelligent design is true, is that the only way that right now we can prove it, or is there another way?
Michael showed you a slide from an interview with me where I said that in a 2004 interview, there wasn't right now a well-articulated theory of biological design. That was 2 years ago, and that's still the case today. Intelligent design in its modern incarnation, it's an old idea, but in its modern form is about 15 years old. It's an unruly teenager. If you want to do historical biology, you have got to do it first via evolutionary theory. That's where the tools are. That's where the well-articulated predictions are. I couldn't give my talk if evolutionary theory wasn't already on the table. Intelligent design is a theory in embryo. What I'm trying to do tonight is to get you interested in the possibility. But the hard work of actually having a theory that can make precise predictions that can be tested is yet to be done. This is one, probably the main reason why I oppose teaching intelligent design in public schools. There is not yet enough to teach. So we're at the position where there's a great promise, but only if you can go past that rule. But to answer your question, right now I'm still in the position of saying evolutionary theory has problems. I'm considering the possibility of design, but precise predictions are down the road.
Damn reasonable. I have to agree with that. Well, but I get a minute, so I might as well say something. So this guy's walking down the street, he's got a parrot on his shoulder. The aristocrats. That's so bad. I forgot what I was going to say now. Testable. So how does something make it into the science curriculum? Paul said so himself. You know, you roll up your sleeves and you get to work. Lynn Margulis is a terrific microbiologist at University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's been promoting this theory of hers called symbiogenesis for 40 years. And it's the idea that the little structures inside your cells, we are made of eukaryote cells, they have little complex species inside them. She thinks those were once themselves individual cells. This is why mitochondria, for example, has its own DNA. Incredible. Not even in the nucleus. It's its own DNA passed down through the matrilineal line and so forth. It's incredible. So she thinks these were all in the little primordial soup by themselves, and they symbiotically got together and became more complex because there was an adaptive function to that. Okay? So Lynn Margulis was on the lunatic fringe for a long time with this theory. She published hundreds of papers, monographs, technical books, popular books, lectures, conferences, TV shows, interviews, the whole thing. She's been doing it for 40 years. Now it's finally starting to trickle down into biology textbooks. That's how it happens. You just got to roll up your sleeves and do the work. And that's what I say to the intelligent, well, that's what you said, but to others who think it should be taught in public schools right now, no, you got to do the work first.
We have time for two more questions, and then we'll begin the closing statements.
This question is primarily for Dr. Shermer. This has been touched on some tonight, but I would like to hear a little bit better explanation on this. It seems like in our discussion that primarily the theory of evolution has been presented as one theory, a monolithic type theory. And I know you are well aware that there are many theories of evolution. And I was wondering maybe if you would address that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, at this conference I was at last June where Lynn Margulis was speaking. It was in the Galapagos, great place for a conference. And it seemed like it would be a contest between who was going to be the most skeptical of traditional Darwinian evolution. And these were just a room full of scientists. There wasn't any creationists there at all. And Lynn Margulis got up and said, I am not a Darwinian. No, she said, I'm not a neo-Darwinian. And I'm not going to let those neo-Darwinians bully me around anymore. You know, she's symbiogenesis is not quite neo-Darwinism anyway. So there's a bunch of these different, you know, sort of competing theories within what we call evolution, or evolutionary theory. But you're right, it's not a monolithic thing where we're all in agreement with each other on exactly how it works. There's great debate. Paul put up a slide of a quote from Stuart Coffin. Stuart Coffin's a complexity theorist and an evolutionary theorist and one of the smartest guys I ever met. I mean, he's just an amazing fellow. But he's skeptical of all sorts of things in mainstream evolutionary theory. But he's not a creationist or anything. He's constructing testable hypotheses, what he does. And so there's lots of ways to do that within the borders of science that don't fall out into this other area that we've been talking about.
I have nothing to add to that. It was a good taxonomy of the current diversity of opinion. I will say one thing. The best way to get excited about intelligent design is actually to read evolutionary biology literature, because it's there that you see scientists struggling with problems that Darwin himself faced. For instance, the origin of adaptive complexity. I guess I do have something to say.
Okay, go for it.
The puzzles that biology faces now are much harder than they were in the 19th century or even when the neo-Darwinian synthesis was articulated. I think this problem of minimal complexity, for instance, will not go away. And it's for that reason, and not really having anything much to do with my religious motivations. I'm a Christian because I read the Bible, not because of DNA or all this other stuff. If science can break free of its bondage, I think, or slavery to methodological naturalism, I think there's a potential for tremendous discoveries using the idea of design. But you have to have the nerve to break free of that rule.
This question is directed to Dr. Nelson. I have in my mind the idea that's fairly common, perhaps more or less, so depending on which department you're in the in cognitive philosophy about the mind being cognitively closed towards certain, or the human mind, excuse me, being cognitively closed towards certain phenomena. And I was wondering, because it seems that humans, I've read other places more scientifically than philosophically oriented, that humans tend to posit design or at least some sort of a process that involves not necessarily a random coincidence, but some sort of plan. The argument that was made in these journals was that basically humans do this not because this is what actually happens, but because we are hardwired biologically to do that, and that explains why actually our intuitions about that are often incorrect. Like, for instance, Newton's intuition that the solar system was all on one plane was actually proven incorrect. And as you said, we can often falsify those theories.
Yeah.
So how would you respond to the claim that all of our intuitions about design or about planning are merely our or some sort of anthropomorphism?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. You're all familiar with the old man in the mountain. It was on the New Hampshire Quarter. Unfortunately, they put that design on there, and then the old man in the mountain fell off the mountain. He's not there anymore. It's a case of, I see a profile, but if I walk around a little bit this way, it disappears. It's not actually there. It just sort of looks like it's there. Now, I agree with you. That's a real problem. But think about it this way, and I'm sure this does not happen at the University of Alabama. I'm teaching a course here. I assign a 5-page paper topic to a class of, let's say, 50 students. The papers come in, and two of them have whole paragraphs that are largely identical. Okay, two separate students, two separate papers, largely identical paragraphs. So I call them in for my office hours at the same time. What's the one explanation I'm not going to let them get away with? That it was coincidence. No one in this room, confronted with that pattern, would let those students say, we just happened to converge to those same paragraphs. Either they copied from each other, or they copied from a third source independently. What they did not do was write those paragraphs on their own. Now, you would make that inference irrespective of your worldview. Buddhist, Hindu, atheist, it doesn't matter. You're not going to let them get away with it. So while I agree with you that that human beings do have these cognitive structures that, you know, cause us, I think, to project design where it's not there, sometimes it's really there. Stonehenge is not a projection. So the challenge for design theory is to be able to sift the real cases of design from the factitious ones like you've described, and I agree that's a real problem.
Yes, but we know students cheat sometimes, and we have a pattern of this, and they fess up when you confront them, and so we have experience with that. We have no experience of a deity actually creating something and, oh, yeah, that's the ones that God made in it or whatever, and those are the ones that nature made, and we have a big track record of both, and when we get something new, we go, well, which belongs in this category or that category? We have zero in this category that we know of, none, other than, well, it looks like the world was designed or something like that, but we have no personal experience of watching God make something, except for sex. Okay. So. And so we have a vast experience of people making things and cheating and murdering and whatever, and that's what we judge it by. So one of the problems with SETI, the SETI astronomers have, is amongst themselves, how will we know when we've detected a signal? And they have a bunch of criteria, but we have zero examples of it. So when one comes in, we can't say, well, this is the rotating stars and this is the aliens because we have all these other aliens we know of. There's none. So it's hard to say. And I think that's part of one of the problems.
Okay. That concludes the question and answer period. We're now going to go ahead and get into our closing remarks. Each of our speakers will have 5 minutes to deliver their closing remark. Since we began opening statements with Dr. Shermer, Dr. Nelson, we're going to begin with Dr. Shermer for closing statements.
Okay, 5 minutes. Well, I do think this really deals with the subject of science and religion deeply, or else we wouldn't care about it. It's why we have courtroom trials fighting about it, where people care deeply about what their kids are learning, and if they think that their kids are learning something that's going to lead them to be immoral or atheists or something they don't like, they're gonna combat it. In my experience, I don't think anybody really cares. The average American who voices an opinion on this subject really cares about the RNA world and whether it led to DNA, the bacterial flagellum, irreducible complexity, or the explanatory filter, or any of these things. What most people care about is, if my kid learns this evolution stuff, is he going to be an atheist? Is he going to, like, be immoral? Is he going to, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll and lose his bearing and have no meaning and purpose in life? And will he not be saved? Will he not go to heaven? Will God not love him? Is America going to hell in a handbasket if those liberal, commie, pinko, atheists teach that evolution stuff in our schools? This is what people really emotionally care about. This is why they sue and go to court over these things. And so, to me, this is the problem that has to be solved, and here's how to solve it. If it turns out that science has discovered something that's true, There must be a way to fit this into your religious worldview. There has to be. Because if it's true, it's just true. That's just the way the world is. You can't look at it and go, well, it can't be true because I want the world to be some other way. That's not the kind of world we live in anymore. Is it possible that God created the universe and the laws of nature, including those of evolution, and that's how he did it? Sure, why not? If God is an eternal being of omniscience and omnipotence, what difference does it make whether he did it 10,000 years ago or 10 billion years ago? It's just zeros after the one. It's meaningless. To an eternal being, it's completely meaningless how many zeros there are. It doesn't matter. And what difference does it make how he created it, whether he went poof with the finger in the Michelangelo painting, or whether he used an RNA to create the DNA, or whether he used electromagnetism or gravity? What difference does it make? They're his laws, so that's the way he did it. It shouldn't make any difference at all on anybody's religious worldviews. And finally, I think there's two other things that Christians and conservatives are missing about evolutionary theory. And that's primarily who objects to or does not accept evolutionary theories, conservatives and Christians. So on those two points. Evolutionary theory gives us the kind of human nature and even, dare I say, family values that conservatives and Christians hold as true. That is, we have a good side and a bad side. We are good, we are evil. If you want to call it original sin or evil in the theological sense, that's fine, I don't care. What evolution says, what Darwin gives us, is that we do indeed have a good side and a dark side. We're cooperative, altruistic, caring, pro-social, kind, nice, generous, all these things. We're also mean and nasty and selfish and avarice and bellicose and tribal and xenophobic and nasty. We have both of those built into us, designed by evolution for two different competing motives of surviving within our group and protecting our group from other groups. And even family values that Christians hold and conservatives hold dear. These are all part of the Darwinian evolutionary worldview. And finally, since most conservatives and Christians are also economically conservative, that is fiscally conservative, Darwin's natural selection is Adam Smith's invisible hand. It's an analog of the two. The two are analogous to each other. And that just like you can't top-down tinker an economy without messing it up, it's best laissez-faire, left alone, that's how life evolved. There is no top-down tinkerer. It came from the bottom up. Now, whether God works from the bottom up, apparently he does. If there is a God, that's how he did it, because that's surely what it looks like actually happened. So for all those reasons, I think there's no threat to anyone's religious beliefs from evolution, in particular science in general. And that, in fact, the Darwinian worldview matches nicely with a lot of the characteristics of what we already believe about humans and society. Thank you.
Well, I don't think I'll need 5 minutes, and you guys have been very patient, so let me get right to the point. A few weeks before I saw Michael in November in Pasadena, I was on a lecturing trip at Stanford, had some free time, and I was reading Cicero, a book that he wrote 40 years before the birth of Christ. Cicero is a great Roman orator, philosopher, statesman, and writer. And the book was Cicero's attempt to understand the possibility of intelligent design. Not a Christian on the scene. You open the book and read it, and he's arguing with Greek philosophies that denied intelligent design. It's kind of a back-and-forth dialogue. Cicero says, you know, if I took the letters of the Greek alphabet and threw them on the ground, I would never form a single sentence of Homer, not even probably a single word. So here is an early Greek philosopher, actually Roman, but he was reading Greek philosophers, struggling to come to grips with the possibility that living things, the world, the universe, exhibited the hallmarks of an intellect, of a mind like our own, but vastly more powerful. These questions about the possibility of design versus strictly natural causation are as old as humankind. They go deep into antiquity. They are not identified in particular throughout intellectual history with Christianity, although I will agree with Michael, in the American debate, there's certainly a very sizable influence of theological the theological assumptions play. My concern is with truth. And that's what I think science should be concerned with. That's what motivates the young graduate students that I work with, who are very carefully, because it's politically quite costly to their careers, exploring these ideas and seeing how they can be made testable. And if what you care about at the end of the day is what's true and what's false, or what might be true and what might be false, then you ought to be brave enough to say methodological naturalism has had a pretty good run for its money, but right now evolutionary theory is badly stalled and in need of a revolution. It's not a revolution that has to do with the evidence. It's a revolution that has to do with getting rid of a very dumb rule that Darwin himself, by the way, did not accept. If you read The Origin of Species, many of Darwin's arguments are theological. He says, why would a creator do the following? Stephen Gould, a mentor to Michael, who died tragically young a few years ago, his most famous essay, The Panda's Thumb, is a theological argument. He says God would not have made the panda's thumb, ergo it evolved. So if breaking that rule is good enough for Darwin and good enough for Stephen Gould, then it ought to be good enough for you. And science, which is powerful and independent and will seek the truth inevitably, will go on its way just fine and will get rid of a dumb philosophy. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
On behalf of University Programs, I'd like to thank you all for coming out tonight. I think we had one heck of a debate tonight. Thank you for coming. And one more time, give them a round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you, John.